Isard, Reel 2. You know, I know it's the Berlin Airlift which is the focus of this, but this is a very interesting account of the war from a young boy who grew up in the war, your teenage years, really. You know, or the very important teenage years.
I'm the man is from a lady, Diana, back from Australia for the wedding, amongst other things. Oh, yes, yes. And I've escorted all our Royal Family all over the world. And I'm a Delta of the Royal Court of Brunei. Putting over the City of London. All these things.
Well, it seems awful to go back to World War II, no, Peter.
No. It was fascinating.
Yes, but if I could ask you, you know, this sort of lull between the end of the Blitz and then suddenly the V1s and V2s.
Yes.
Do you remember the sort of... Was it dramatic, that start, or was there warning? Yes.
Well, no, there was no warning. Not for the ordinary hoi-polloi. My father-in-law, and I think my father as well, my father-in-law, who I didn't know at that time, was a policeman, and they were told that it was going to happen. And they were quite frightened because you knew that there was no human hand up there, that the thing was completely automatic. They made this terrible noise, they called them buzz bombs, and that was because of the new pulse jets that they were using, which were very, very basic power units, which had this shutter going back and then forward inside on springs. To compress the kerosene mixture and such like. And they made a noise. And of course, just south of here, we had something like, oh, I don't know, 5,000 balloons. And right along the North Downs was a complete arsenal of anti-aircraft guns. It was complete. And in Penge, which starts just up the road here, in the square mile, they had over 100. They were quite frightening. In fact, it was so bad that at one point my doctor ordered me off out of the area altogether because I was like this. And I went up for a fortnight to Derbyshire. But they were. I think it was because they were automatic. And that you felt that there was no chance of it not doing its job. You know, I mean, a lot of them were shot down, not around here because they didn't shoot them down. I mean, once they'd gone past the that long barrage of balloons and guns, they couldn't because they would do more damage possibly. You know. And then of course we went on to the V2s, the rockets.
What was the difference between them?
Well, a rocket was just as you've got today. It was an intercontinental, well, it wasn't intercontinental, but it was a ballistic missile which went literally like that. but in those days, of course, it had no control. So it just went and you didn't hear it coming. You might, excuse me, as one or two people saw the vapor trail, because they reached pretty far, you know. But when they came down, you didn't know. There was just this, you know, we'd be sitting here, and the next thing you know, there was this ginormous explosion, because it was going faster than sound, so you didn't hear it coming anyway. We didn't have any around here. The nearest one was in Lewisham, which was very large shopping centre. You know the Cop Tower? Do you know Lewisham? The Cop Tower there.
Excuse me.
And... yeah, that was pretty terrible, those things. Because, but they weren't that many, fortunately. I mean, he turned his attention with them to Antwerp, which we were trying to capture at the time.
Do you think they had a more sort of lasting effect on morale than, say, the Blitz experience because of the features you described?
I think they probably did. As I say, I think it was because, I never really thought about it, but I suppose it was because there was nothing you could do about it. And we used to stand in the street and watch them, and they didn't come to V1s to do them, they came, you could see 3, 4, 5 at a time, in parallel line coming across the sky. And as soon as the engine stopped, it just went straight down. The V1s didn't hit anyway, and I think you're quite right that they did have a greater effect in a very short term on the morale.
The other thing I would like to ask you, Peter, you know, one hears an awful lot about people hanging together and, you know, collective efforts in World War Two. There are others who sort of decide otherwise. But what, in your experience in this area, do you think about that? Did people help each other more?
Yes. I mean, if in the case of Doodlebugs, you could dash into anybody's house and they'd let you in, and if there was a bomb somewhere or there was an incident, you know, everybody would be out with cups of tea and mum would be filling up the, you've got a kitchen, a hospital with some, you know, all this sort of thing. Bearing in mind, of course, the rationing was on at the time and stuff like that. But no, it was a very, close. People really got on well together, obviously exceptions. And the other thing, of course, certainly at the beginning of the war, was the suspicion which greeted anybody who was acting suspiciously or such like. I mean, there was a program on television the other night, I don't know if you saw it, about the secret side of Dad's army. You know, they shot 52 people during the war by mistake. Schoolboys on bicycles near airfields and things like that. It was really the very first sort of war. And when my dad used to talk about the settlement in the First World War, and the doctor was born, especially Croydon, when they were living at the time. But this was, you were involved. Mm-hmm. Everybody was involved. You saw a neighbor lost their husband, or, people with POWs, and all sorts of things that happened.
I suppose your father had some harrowing experiences on the railways, didn't he?
If you can imagine the railway station, which is still in Elephant and Castle, is 30 feet above the road. The signal box was 25 feet above that. They had a bit like the... what was that thing that the Spanish Inquisition where they put people inside and shut the door? You know, the swords and things.
Oh, yes, I know.
Well, they had that shape shelter in the signal box, which they put again and shut the door. They had eye holes so they could look out and see what was going on. But If that bomb had dropped on that signal box, that would have plummeted nearly 50 feet to the ground. And he was watching one night during the night of the blitz. He was looking out of the window, and just across the road, the other side of the road, was a warehouse, which was on fire. And there were four turntable ladders, one on each side. And another bomb came down, and when the bomb went up, they went down anymore. And all that sort of thing. And I'm sure he saw a lot more than he ever talked about. My dad, he actually resigned from the police, or he retired from the police very early because he couldn't, he was in a traffic accident, and he couldn't stand to get up children out of the road anymore. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I suppose, as you say, total war, from what you have described, your own experience, the civilians were certainly in it as much as the troops.
I mean, our first real experience of the war, I suppose, was I was at Beckenham Grammar School, the playing field backed onto the railway line, which is the main railway line between Dover and London. And in the 44, we were given carte blanche to raid the touch up and take everything. We went up to the railway bank and we were feeding the people coming back from Dunkirk. Trainloads of soldiers, all French, Belgian, English, or lots of them, Indian and such like. And we all picked up French soldiers' helmets and badges and bits of shrapnel and things like that. And these kids climbing up the bank and such like that. That was our first real decided to do their training course squadron should have an airplane. Not to fly, but to have an airplane for instruction purposes. And we were given a fairly battle bomber, which we took delivered to our school and which we assembled on the school field. And, it really was, you know, everything was. And of course, in the air training corps, we all learned to be the aircrew. That's what we were there for. That's what the ATC was greatly enlarged to cover. Still goes on for that. I'm chairman of the air training corps in Kenya. We've got set up for the units at about 2,000 kids. That keeps me very busy, I'm delighted to say. But, so everything, we were all involved, and I mean, some of the ATC cadets, the older ones, they actually flew with the air transport auxiliary pilots delivering aircraft. I don't know if you were here in this area, but certainly those squadrons that were around the factories which were making the aircraft, the senior cadets went on, because you know, there were people like Becky Sharp, was about 5'4", and she was flying Lancasters on her own. Just an ATC cadet to not be able to carry it up and down and things like that. So everybody was involved, except the very old people and babies. The civil defence was everybody. And, I remember one of our guys, he'd actually been at a bit of Eastern Africa in some place. Oh, Kuzo Amara, and he was telling Kuzo Amara about the Arabs, and he used to dig out a square as close in the middle of the night of these days there. And there were the boys, you know, so it was
so I suppose it's understandable why you went into the RAF, you know, in, what was it, 1946?
46, yeah. Well, I remember getting my pre-call-up medical, because in those days it was still part of the wartime thing. It hadn't actually been labelled in National Service at that time. And we all had the odd numbers, and I actually got the odd with a suit and a couple of shirts and shoes and a running coat and hat, you know, which was quite impressive.
So you were demobbed from what? From the Air Force?
In 48.
In 48, yes. This would be your BOAC job? Or the...
No. I'm the BOAC job went on until 46.
I see, yeah.
And then I was called up in the Air Force. I wanted to be air crew, but they had so many pilots, they didn't know what to do with them. And in fact, my first job when I done my what we call square bashing and then ordinary military training, shooting and everything, I was going in, I was listed to go into the Air Force as a movements assistant. And when I finished my square bashing, they said, well, there are no courses available, so you're going to be missing for it. It's a clerk in a records office at Gloucester. So we went down to the records office at Gloucester. And I did that for, I suppose, about 4 months. All I did was I was promoting flight sergeants to warrant officer on time promotion, taking things out of the air, putting it over there, somebody was notifying them, they were now being promoted. And we were troop trained around. We joined at Padgate, and then the troop trained in Wilmslow, and from Wilmslow down to Gloucester, we had our troop training. So it was all still wartime. I mean, still a lot of flying going on. And
this was 46, was it?
46. And of course, unknown to us at that point in time, there were a lot of problems around the world. We were really sorting out problems for ourselves, you know, even in Malaysia and Cyprus and all those things, you know, and the Spanish were knocking on the door of Gibraltar, and the Russians were, well, they were really getting pain. And while I was at great disorganisation, I'll tell you, in the Air Force, while I was at Gloucester, all the drivers taking us to work every day, and it's virtually all they did, to get to work on board, so by one of the pilots who had been made redundant. And we nearly had a mutiny there. It was touch and go, I think, at one time.
This was in what place?
Gloucester, RAF Innsworth, and Gloucester Records Office, which is now very cool to the training and personnel command. And one day I was called into the office, and the client said, your trade in movements has been closed. They've got far too many, and so you've got to go for something else. So I said, so they won't take these airfield at the moment. I said, well, motorboat crew, that sounds all right. It'd be great fun, chasing about in SES vehicles. No, you can't do that unless you sign on for 5 years. So I said, I'm not signing on at this point in time. But he said, one thing on the motorboat you can do, he said, if you want, he said, you can become a marine fitter. And I said, what's that? He said, well, that's sort of like a flight engineer on SES vehicles. So I said, I don't know. He said, well, it's a top payback at the time. So off I went to Phoenix there. And everybody was absolutely horrified when I arrived because I was the only person on that course who had never done anything with boats. All the others were apprentice shipwrights and all sorts of things. And nobody failed this course since long until the radio was on it. Because you know, Lawrence became a man. So we did this 16-week course. And I learned quite a lot about engines. We had a lot of fun with the SES units and assembly and flying boats and all sorts. And the day before the trade test, at the end of the course, we had a day off to SWAT. And the swatting was going to consist of me sitting on my bed and the other 11 members of the course fired questions at me. They were all quite confident. And so we all went to breakfast that morning, and while we were having breakfast, the tenor went and ordering me to go to the orderly room, you see. So I was escorted there in case I escaped by the rest of the court. And we went in, and the fire sergeant said, "Are you out?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "You're posted." "What do you mean I'm posted?" "And when we finish the court," he said, "I know that." He said, "Got a records office express posting here for you." I said, "But I'm not going in ACO-222D, aircraft and general duties under training." "Well," he said, "I can't help that." He said, "You've got to be RAF Waterbeach 51 Squadron today." So, of course, the boys were bad, and they wasn't going to fail the course. So they helped me pack the kit, and I was on the 9 o'clock train out of Phoenix there. And I eventually arrived in Waterbeach, which was just north of Cambridge. And I went down there and went on to the airfield. Had their yachts sitting around, four engine transport aircraft. And so I reported to the adjutant of the squadron, and walked in, bought the kit, saluted the ships, packed that up, and said, "This is a real Air Force, not this training bit you've done." He said, "It's not this saluting bit." And a cup of tea, which is a very ugly flight with pen and smashing baby. So he put and made me a cup of tea, and I said, "Well, here I am for air movements." And he said, "We don't have any air movements people here," he said. And I said, "Well, what am I here for then?" So he said, "Well, you were in BOAC, man. How did you know I'd been in BOAC? I'm only a Commonwealth Guard man." And he said, "You're going to be an air coordinator." So I said, "What the hell is that?" So he said, "Well, in BOAC, you had your flight clerks on the flying boats and the bigger airplanes." He said, "That's what you're going to do." So I said, "You know I'm going to fly?" So he said, "Yeah." So I said, "Oh, I see." I said, "Well, I better get ready, and I better go find myself a bed." He said, "No, you're sleeping in a camp bed there." So I said, "Thanks very much." I said, "Why am I sleeping in here?" He said, "We're on the 6 o'clock airplane in the morning down the line. And Wiltshire, to do the course." Well, it would appear that somebody had made a boo-boo in the Air Ministry, and they had demobbed virtually all the air movements people in the UK, all of them. I mean, overseas, you know, read about the mutiny in India, the RAF mutiny, the people who were coming home, and they were all worried that they didn't get jobs there anymore. So I really flew down the line and did the course.
Was that a demanding course?
No, it didn't teach me a lot. I didn't already know from Croydon and the LSE. It was very pleasant. It was a very pleasant for about 16 weeks, I suppose. It was very pleasant. The old movement building in those days was in the middle of the airfield. We had a 12-bore shotgun. And we could go around the airfield in the evening. It was a beautiful sunset. It was lovely summer, 47. And we used to go around and shoot a few in there and present them to the cook and stuff like that. So that was good. And I did a bit of flying down there.
Well, what essentially is that job?
Well, an airport master. Well, these days it's called an air loadmaster. So that's the modern equivalent. You're basically there to, A, make sure that all the loading of the aircraft is correct, that the passengers were looked after. Of course, in those days there was no catering facilities. It was all lunch boxes and tea and cold drinks and things like that. You were obviously looking after the well-being of the passengers as much as you could in an aeroplane that basically was didn't have any soundproofing and it wasn't air conditioned and it wasn't pressurized or anything like that. But on one occasion, we came back over the Massif in France, and we literally had to go up to try and get above the icing at 18,000 feet, and we couldn't, and I had all the passengers in oxygen masks and that sort of thing. And we also were responsible for checking the weight and balance forms, arms and moments, and you've got to get the water flying boats because you put all the stuff in, and then you row around it, and if it was sitting in the water square, it was fine. But with these, you have to do all these calculations, which I couldn't do today, I think. I mean, it's all done on a computer anyway. Sort of mopping the skipper's brow when it was hot and things like that. Going across the Indian Ocean at one point with the captain and the first officer in their underpants. It was so hot, and I was pouring cold water over their heads because the automatic pilot had gone, and so they had to actually fly the airplane. And that was the time when the first officer said, "Look at that, and we all looked at it. We weren't flying very hard." And there were seven water spouts. It's just like looking at a forest of big trees, We lost a few. We just got transport things. One went into down in the Nicobars, and another one crashed in a swamp and so on. It wasn't all easy stuff, although it was for me, I found it was very nice. I went from the course of line and back to Water Beach when I was immediately issued with all the aircrew kit. Although at that time we never ever got a flying badge, which has been a point of contention with a lot of us ever since. I was a corporal acting sergeant then, immediately. And I was also on flying pay. So instead of earning four bob a day, I was earning something like 12 and 6. Now I was very rich. I used to go into Cambridge for tea dances and take out a pump on the river and do it. It was quite nice. And this went on, we were flying, our squadron was flying on two routes, one to Singapore via Malta, Havana, which is still a big military base in Iraq. That was a super place.
What was the name of that?
Havana. Havana. H-A-B-B-A-N-Y-A-H. Havana. It was between the Euphrates and the canal. And it was built in the 30s, and might have been started in the 20s. The local sheriffs tried to take it over during the war, and there was a famous, the Battle of Havana. There was a train there for during the war, and they actually used cargo to bomb the sheriffs and all sorts. It's quite an interesting story.
Would this have been, this is in Iraq?
Yes, about 50 miles south of Baghdad. And it had a race course, and it had a swimming pool and a golf course. Every now and again, they had to open the sluice gates and let the the place was flooded. The whole of the camp was enclosed in a large fence. The runways were outside the fence, and at night we used to pull the aircraft in and close the gates. And the camel train and the silk route used to come right past the gates. And at night we'd walk down to the gates and there'd be all these fires and mounds of Adams and camels and stuff like that. And they all used to stop there and look through the fence because they thought it was a garden of Eden. It was all green and trees and everything. It's a beautiful place. Really wonderful.
I suppose also, you know, going to Singapore via Malta. That must have been interesting, so soon after the war.
Yes.
Well, what was Malta like, you know, in those years?
It was very badly bombed, of course. I mean, what was it George Bernard Shaw said? He said, the land of bells and smells where every female thing is pregnant. It was good because in those days, and I don't know what it's like now. I went back in 54, I went back. With the reserve. But in those days, of course, Grand Harbour was still full of the Mediterranean fleet, and you know, the airfield was all you go, 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 and you were still in a wartime situation, really, so nobody was shooting at us, we're not in Malta, anyway. And it was interesting there because it was the only place I actually stayed in a nominated air crew mess. Not a sergeant's mess, or an officer's mess, but a for transit air crew, because we were usually there only one night. Of course, we didn't fly at night. We stayed the night in Malta, we stayed the night in Uganda, we stayed the night in Karachi, we stayed the night in Colombo, and then we stayed several days in Singapore, and then we repeated the process. Mm-hmm. The other route we flew was down to Karachi, and then we did in one day, we went Karachi, Delhi, Karachi, and then home. They were good. They were, the passengers were, as in civil airlines, of course, in those days, they were people who had to travel. They were doctors and colonial officials and service chiefs and all that sort of thing. People with a couple of compassionate cases home, and we bought one chap, one poor chap home from Ukraine. Maybe expression to go to Delhi. That comes from the military medical hospital in India, a place called Deer Valley. We couldn't find him as we were ready to take off, and he was outside leaning on one of the cars saying, "Oh, come on, I'll swing this for him." And he wasn't all that bad, but he was obviously had a very bad time.
How about Singapore? Had that picked itself up by this time?
Well, it was, I mean, it was, if you've been to Singapore, Singapore today is nothing like it was in those days. And between the airport, which we were using in the first one, and the Changi, which has since become the new international airport, that was a pier steel plate runway laid on the sand, which was a lot longer than the tide was out and more than the tide was in. But between Changi and the main, area of Raffles were all these terrible Chinese slums, and the smell was absolutely awful, you know, going in. It was a pleasant place to be though. I mean, even in those days it was pretty crime free, as it is today. And it was rather interesting that my wife and I represented Qantas at the present Sultan of Brunei's coronation. And we had the pleasure of offering to reclaim you, just the two of us, and we were talking to him, absolutely fascinating. but no, it was an interesting part of the world. I would like at that time to be able to go to Hong Kong. Karachi, of course, was still India. We were there, we were now doing partition, which was pretty bloody to say the least.
Did you experience much?
Not really. We heard stories and we were told, you know, not to go out and things like that. There were some horrific stories, I mean, mob violence. I mean, there was an American police in, I think it was in Karachi, one of the outskirts. There was something to the crowd, you know, there were some British military police saying, "No, why in captain's and the British police realised, the situation, because they'd been there a long time.